And they came back and they said, cut the yellow wire. I'll never forget that. You're not allowed to use four-letter words. So I laughed and I went, you may have missed the point in my briefing that I sent, that everything is thermally scorched. There is no yellow, pink, red. Everything is pitch
all black.
Black.
All the wires are black at this point.
Everything's black.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
This is Stephen Phillips. I have the deck and the con for today's podcast. Today, my guest is Lieutenant Commander Tony Nehichevansky, U.S. Navy retired. The topic is the explosive ordnance disposal response to the Iraqi air-to-surface attack on USS Stark on May 17, 1987. During the 1980s, Iran and Iraq were at war. They sought to erode each other's ability to finance that war by conducting the naval strategy of guerre de course, or commerce raiding. Both sides attacked the other's oil industry at sea in what became known as the Tanker War. Iraq conducted air-to-surface attacks. Iraqi Air Force planes would take off from southern Iraq, fly over Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and then turn to the east for the Iranian coast. Iran had an exclusion zone declared along their coast, where they hoped their tankers delivering oil to the customers around the world could transit unfettered. The Iraqi aircraft would approach the exclusion zone, turn on their radar, and fire an Exocet missile at the first target they encountered without visually identifying it. On May 17, 1987, an Iraqi Air Force aircraft, in a case of inadequate navigation and misidentification, fired two Exocet missiles at USS Stark, an Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigate. The story of the engagement and the damage control effort is enthralling. Sadly, many sailors were injured and 37 of Stark's crew lost their lives. For further reading, I recommend Missile Inbound by Jeffrey Levinson and Randy Edwards, published by the Naval Institute Press. Perhaps someday I'll do a podcast covering these events. Today, we will focus on the post-blast assessment of the Stark, which became a render-safe procedure as it was discovered that one of the two Exocet missiles did not detonate. To discuss this in detail, I'm joined by the EOD officer who led the response. Tony Nehichevansky began his military career as a ranger in Vietnam, conducting long-range reconnaissance patrols. He went green to blue and returned to Vietnam aboard a minesweeper, USS Conquest, in support of Operation Endsweep, the mine clearance of Haiphong Harbor. Tony later attended and graduated from Naval School Explosive Ordnance Disposal, graduating in 1975. As listeners will surmise by his rank at retirement, Tony is a Mustang, promoted to Senior Chief Petty Officer, Chief Warrant Officer in August of 1984, and eventually as a Limited Duty Officer in a field which at the time was called Special Operations Officer and now is known as EOD Officer. During the Stark Exocet response, Tony was the Training Officer at EOD Mobile Unit 2 in Virginia Beach, Virginia. He later served as the intelligence officer for all Navy EOD forces, which included foreign material acquisition during Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Tony's last assignment was as commanding officer EOD Mobile Unit 10, during which he supported the TWA Flight 800 recovery operations and conducted U.S. Secret Service support for the 1996 Olympic Games and 1996 presidential elections. He retired from the U.S. Navy in 1997. It is important to note that Tony's personal decorations include the Bronze Star Medal with V for Valor and two Purple Hearts. After the Navy, Tony became the Government Accounts Manager for Mercury, Marine, and Racing, providing outboard engines to the U.S. Navy. Today, he is Vice President of Diesel Outboard LLC. Tony, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tony, first I'd like the audience to get to know a little bit more about you. What drew you to go green to blue, leaving the Army Rangers to serve in the Navy and as an EOD technician?
That's an interesting question, and it goes back to the early 70s. Vietnam veterans were not regarded as welcome home people that did things in defense in the Defense Department's policy. We were seen as baby killers, mutilators, murderers, and everything else they could come up with. So it was very difficult to get a job. I came back with the great hopes, honorably discharged, decorated combat veteran, of integrating in Miami, where my sister lives. I wanted to get into hotel management, and I simply could not get a job. As soon as they looked at my resume, the attitude that prevailed after Kent State and in the early 70s, if you were a Vietnam veteran, you were nothing short of the scum of the earth. So I ended up digging ditches for $1.65 an hour. A lot of ditches in that limestone in Miami, Florida, which became the foundations for the highway motels that you see driving down south. After about 9 months of this, disgruntled, just sad, thought I'd done my duty, done everything correctly, I went to go back in the Army. And I walked in. I was literally starving. I'd been out of work for about a week. I went in. I said, I've got to be worth something. And the Army recruiter wasn't there. Highly disappointed, I looked across the passageway, and there was probably one of the most handsome men I'd ever seen. There was a senior chief petty officer in his summer whites, all of his ribbons adorned his uniform, perfectly trimmed haircut, reading a magazine, and I walked up, knocked at the door, and I said, are you open to a prior veteran coming into the Navy? I'll never forget, he said, well, do you like deep sea fishing and going around the world? He had my heart because I love both of those. He said, well, come on in, sit down. So I did, and we started chatting, and he looked at my DD-214, and clearly he saw that that I brought a number of skills to the table. He said, well, what do you want to do? Easily impressionable now. I had just finished watching The Fighting Seabees. And actually, I said, you know, I want to drive a DA-8 bulldozer. I want to join the Seabees. When I was in Vietnam and we invaded Cambodia during Lam Son 719, I'll never forget going through the rubber plantations and these gigantuan D-12 caterpillars with big spikes on the forward leading edge corner of their blades would run straight through the tree and split them in half, and they would just literally drive over them, and we were marching behind them on our way to meet the 33rd NVA in Cambodia. And I said, man, that is power. I wanna drive one of those. I wanna be a fighting CB. Well, he looked at me, he said, nice choice, no billets available. I went, dang. I said, what else do you want to do? I said, well, I'm a skydiver, and I was a shooter in Vietnam. I said, I blew things up. I had training in demolition. I'd like to be a SEAL. And he looked, and he said, well, there are no billets to just go into SEAL training. And I said, what about EOD? I'd been reading about that. And he said, the problem is you have to be a career-designated petty officer to get into EOD. At this time, there were only 190 EOD sailors worldwide. There were only two training units, and they were very small, and two mobile units, and they were very small. I mean, when I say small, when we did deployments, we did 19-day turnarounds after a nine-month deployment. That's small. So I said, well, how do I get there? So he told me I had to go to the fleet first to get this credible standing in order to get into any of the special operations communities. And I said, fine. He said, well, there's a billet in Charleston. He goes, I can put in, given you were an E5, to see if I can get a waiver to bring you in as an E4. And I looked at him and I said, "Chief, I'm starving. I haven't eaten in 2 days." I says, "I don't need a waiver. I'll go in." He said, "I can get you in as a seaman." And then he took me to Woolworths and bought me a big old cheeseburger and a cherry Coke. And I was on my way. That was the beginning of my Navy career.
So what did you do first? Were you like a deck seaman? Did you go to an A school?
No, I didn't go to an A school. So they put me on a plane, sent me directly to Charleston, put me in the transient barracks, and gave me a watch. So I'm sitting there at the quarterdeck, 2 a.m, all the drunks are coming in the transient barracks, and this guy comes in and signs in the log, sign in and sign out log, and it says BM1 whoever. And I said, "What's a BM1? He said, "You're in the Navy, bap," and he smacked me upside the head. He goes, "You stay right there. I'll be right back." He was half drunk, and I just knew I'd been corrected. 5 minutes later, that man stumbled back down the stairs, and he gave me the Blue Jackets manual. And he said, "I'll be here tomorrow morning, and this weekend I'm here for 10 days. You're going to learn about the Navy." So I had no boot camp, no Navy boot camp. It wasn't required. I'd already been through Army boot camp. I'd already been to war. I'd already been wounded. I'd already been brought home. You know, they didn't do boot camp. So I didn't know anything about the Navy. I got a pair of dungarees issued. I got stuck in a transit barracks and put on quarterdeck watch. And I didn't know what the hell quarterdeck was. Well, that BM1, I owe him an awful lot. I read that Blue Jackets manual. I read every term, line, and he came down 4 or 5 times a day, and every time he passed, he held a quiz. What chapter are you on? He could quote that Blue Jackets manual. And lo and behold, my orders were changed, and I was put on a minesweeper, USS Assurance MSO 521, right there in Charleston, South Carolina. So I quickly learned how to become, minesweep boatswain mate under the rough hand of BM1 Hank Harrington and BMC Charlie Quick. It wasn't long. My level of discipline was far more mature than the other seamen, having served as an NCO and been in combat. And it wasn't long, and I really loved doing this, you know, the idea of where the fleet goes. We've been, you know, getting right back into that leadership role. And within 6 months, I was the leading seaman running everything going on during minesweep operations on the deck. Shortly after that, they called for volunteers to go to Haiphong Harbor. The end of the war was coming up on what was to be called Operation End Sweep. Of course, my hand went up, volunteered. Several of us did, not many. And we were flown over to Hawaii. And we picked up an NRF, Navy Reserve ship, and she was in sad shape, the USS Conquest, MSO 488. So we kind of brought her back to life in Hawaii and did the long, slow steam across the Pacific to hit Guam. We went through degaussing in Guam. It just inherently riddled with breakdowns and issues. This boat had never done much in years. From there, we got degaussed. We went on to the Philippines, and we hit one of the super typhoons, Pamela or something. And it was so drastic, we lost all the sweep gear off the decks when we pulled into the PI, the boards. The planks on the side of the hull had split at the bow and were popped out. The mast had lost her guy wires. We were a wreck. That was a bad storm. And I remember being chained to the helm, strapped to the helm. A lot of the guys were just deathly sick. I've never been seasick in my life. And being the seaman, I stood helm watches, underway helm watches. So I was brought up and pretty much had the helm through that storm till we got into the PI.
Talking about iron men and wooden ships, right?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I lived the life. I loved that because I was passionate. So many people were still like the ones I despise, the draft dodgers. And you know, a couple of the kids that worked in my team in the division would go on Liberty and wear these clothes with the anti-war stuff. And I had a lot of counseling with them. We just thought about things differently. So this was awesome, the chance to go back. It didn't dawn on me until afterwards that we were about to participate in the one operation that would bring the Vietnam War to an end, that North Vietnam would sign the agreement with Dr. Henry Kissinger, and we would start the drawdown. So it was exciting, and when I was there, I worked with the EOD team. I was the LPO on the deck, and I ran the Z-Bird. And it was kind of funny because they had a thing, anytime you were on the water all day, the corpsman, when you came back, you got spirits, they would call it, medicinals. And I said, are you kidding me?
So it was like a shot of whiskey?
It was. They would give you two little airline bottles of brandy.
I love it.
And you know, the old Master Chief Eddie Knopp and the tough VOD guys, they'd get up there and inhale that stuff. Well, I didn't drink, and I knew I wanted to go to EOD school. I'd spent so many hours with the Master Chief on the water and running the boats, and I ran the side, everything that supported him. I said, you want mine? And before he could say yes, they were gone. So I gave him mine, and I was a Coca-Cola drinker then, so, and happy to do it.
So that inspired you then all the more to go EOD, working with those guys. So,
absolutely.
Yes, so you went to EOD school. When did you graduate?
1975. 3B75 was my class.
And so let's go broad brush over your major command tours up until Stark Response.
Sure, I will. Graduated EOD school, went back to jump school on my way to Hawaii, was assigned to Group 1. Was assigned to, which was Group 1 and EOD Mobile Unit 1 in Hawaii, did a number of deployments there, was selected to go to the North Pole for several months, and then I came back and went over to the Marine Mammal Program, which was a very hand-picked program for a number of years. We were training the mammals before we turned them over to the Navy for usage as calibrated systems. From there, I had a tour in Seal Beach, California, and then they stood up EOD Mobile Unit 2 on the East Coast. I was transferred. They had huge manpower shortages. I made a quick deployment in 2 and came back and became the chief of the command under Bill Bacon. Mike Murray, Commander Murray, and then Bill Bacon, and finally John Schick were the three COs, and Stan Denham, the four COs I served under. So in that time, I went through every department and division as a leader, you know, as either the leading enlisted the command. I was commissioned to W-2 in 84. I stayed in there until 88. So it was in that time frame. I'd done a few more deployments.
That the Stark occurred, yeah. So Mobile Unit 2 at that time, was it at Fort Story and then Little Creek, or was it at Fort Story that whole time?
No, it was at Fort Story, and we literally built it with our hands. You know, the boat shops.
Right.
It was all hands on deck. We rented jackhammers, and we poured concrete, and we put up the Butler buildings, and we literally, cases of foam, that expando foam. No architecture or anything. We needed a roof over our heads.
Right.
We had no money. Vietnam was dried up. Mm-hmm. We were really a bastard stepchild of nobody.
Yeah. I came in the community much after you, Tony, but I'd heard that, and I've talked to folks that said that they'd been at Mobile Unit 2 when it was at Fort Story, and of course that's now where Training and Evaluation Unit 2 is, and Mobile Unit 2 and everything else, they're all consolidated now. You know, there was a time Mobile Unit 6 was in Charleston. That was my first command.
Right.
But let's bring it to the Stark then. And now I'm going to come up to the that time period. I gave the intro of what was happening in the war. So, Tony, prior to the Stark Response, did you support other operations in the Persian Gulf?
Yes, I did. Actually, myself and a number of other OICs at Mobile Unit 2, I remember Jim Reed going on one of the large super tankers where there were some unexploded Mark 82s that were dropped on it by the Iranians. And then I was called to respond to a merchant tanker, the merchant vessel Greek Koryana, the Greek merchant vessel Koryana. This is one that had been attacked by the Iranians, and they'd fired two AS-12 missiles into the boiler room of the ship. One detonated and the other did not. Coriana made it to Abu Dhabi, where she laid moored or anchored just safely away from the boating traffic. The Greek EOD went in and could not resolve the issue, and through State Department, we got a request to go over there and support the Greeks in getting that ship safe from the AS-12. It was a long journey. I was given the tasking as the training officer at the time. I was asked to pick a team. I was going over. I knew what I was going over to do, so we had the correct publications and tools that I felt we needed. They laid on a SAM mission from Norfolk, Virginia, and we flew halfway around the world. I think the only stop was Rota, Spain, to change the flight crew and to pick up another 141 because the flight hours were too long for one pilot to do it in one shot. So we land in Bahrain, we're briefed, and we get on board a Perry-class frigate, and I really don't remember the name. And we're all amped up would be the word, to we're there now, we're getting into our working mode, we're rehearsing and briefing myself and my chief and my other two guys, and let's go. So off we went. We had a bit of a steaming away from NSA Bahrain down to Abu Dhabi. Into the evening, I could hear the turbines wind down, and I went up to the flybridge, and I sensed that we had slowed down. And this might be 1 o'clock in the morning or so. And I asked the officer of the deck, I said, why have we slowed down? And he said, well, some Soviet Mayan mines had been spotted in the water. And these are free-floating mines. And I was advised that we're slowing down to 4 knots because the ship could create enough of a bow wake that if it came within proximity of this mine, that it would simply be pushed away by the wake. I was thankful for that. Disappointed we slowed down, but thankful for that. So off we went. They made the decision to keep going through the minefield. We had to get to Coriana. This has been close to 10 days since the attack, and the ship's anchored, and the people are terrified, and they had battle damage from the first missile, etc. So off we went. At daylight, we picked up speed again when all the lookouts could get up there and observe the water, and they put the helo in the water to fly ahead and kind of run recon on the water to see if they could spot anything. So we finally come around to Abu Dhabi. We see Coriana moored, and we lay off perhaps a mile or two. I had spoken with the captain of the ship about what we need to do, and in EOD, we always approach any hazard or request for assistance with what's called a long-range reconnaissance, then a close-in reconnaissance, then we come back and we develop a plan of attack, and then we go execute the plan of attack. So, seeing as how the missile was in the boiler room, the long-range reconnaissance, we skipped that, said, let's just go to the close-in. So, myself and Chief Les Stone, what a great, great LPO, man. So myself and Les, we were both accustomed to rappelling, and we rigged the aircraft to rappel us down onto this oiler, this tanker. We take off, and we're in the air flying about 2 miles towards Coriana, and as we're coming down from perhaps 2,000 feet as we're making our approach down to get stable over her deck that we can rappel onto the ship, we look over and we saw the two black streaks of smoke at sea level, maybe at 100 feet above the water. One of the aircraft in the U.S. inventory notorious for a footprint black streak of smoke was the F-4 Phantom. So we knew there were two F-4 Phantoms, of which the Iranians had many. They came in blasting. As we were slowing to hover and make our ascent, the helo just rapidly pulls away, just about threw us out the door, but we had belts on. And that's when all of this came to light. The F-4s came in, made a straight beeline for Coriana, dropped more. They weren't missile launches. These were bombs. So I'm assuming Mark 82, 500-pound low-drag GB bombs. And we heard the concussion, the boom, 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 and the smoke and the fire. And meanwhile, pictured a helo making a right turn and pulling away as fast as it can and getting back to our ship.
Tony, I've got to stop you. That's insane. So do you think the Iranians knew that you, like, were they waiting for you to come in and descend on the deck to make the attack?
Yes, I do think that. I didn't initially think that. Initially, none of it made sense to me. But once I had a chance to debrief with the captain of the ship, and I put some of the circumstances together, a few things came to light. One is everybody on the planet Earth just about knew that the American EOD team was coming to work on Coriana.
Because it was in the media.
It was all in the media, all in the newspaper, so the timing was there. The other part that can be speculated, but had we not slowed down for the Mayan mines, we would have been on the ship in about 6 hours into a procedure working on the missile. Had that, in fact, been the case, the captain of the ship would have been compelled to defend us when he saw the Iranian aircraft coming to attack the ship. And that was the motive behind the attack, was to draw the Americans into conflict by shooting on the aircraft to protect us because we were in the ship.
That's amazing. And for the listeners, the Mayan mines were on the surface in part because the Iranians were laying mines throughout the Persian Gulf as another method to interrupt the tankers. Some of them would be just dropped as moored mines. Others would break free, and they'd be in the and found in the, you know, on the surface after they broke free from their moorings. And the Iranians employed Russian-made Mayan mines and MO8 mines, and then they made their own that were dubbed the Sadov-01 and Sadov-02 based on those designs. Commonly, through the period of time, folks would see dead sheep on the surface. There were all these sheep carriers, and they would kick the dead sheep off the back of them, and then they would get bloated and turn turtle, and their four legs would stick in the air. And so often sheep were mistaken for mines on the surface. It created a confusing environment. So the render safe procedure on the Coriana never happens. What happened to the ship? Did it go down? Did the crew members survive?
No, the ship didn't go down, and we steamed away. In our leaving the scene, I was aware, because I was on the bridge and in communications with the people on the bridge of the ship, there were additional injuries or deaths. The ship was combating, doing firefighting from the impact, but she was on her own. I was returned and on a plane back to America before I could follow up. We left her burning. There were casualties, and she did not sink at that time.
There were over 400 merchant sailors that died during Operation Earnest Will, during the tanker war. It really was a dangerous time to be in the Persian Gulf. So that really sets the stage then for the response to the USS Stark. After she was attacked by what we now know is an Iraqi Falcon 50, a Learjet that had been configured to carry two Exocets, not a Mirage F1 as what was surmised up until very recently. And that itself perhaps is another story in a podcast for another day. But so the premise was already there, Tony, that you would be called to respond to something happened in the Persian Gulf, and that's what happened in the case of the Stark. So let's start there. What happens when you get recalled or called to go and respond to the Stark attack?
Well, if I could start with a little humor, first thing I had to do was sober up and drink about 6 cups of coffee because I had been offshore tuna fishing all day.
Right.
And I had just gotten back in, very happy.
It was a weekend. It was a Sunday that she got hit.
It was. Yeah. And we didn't have text phones or anything like that. And I got in, and my wife met me at the dock and said, the captain's trying to get a hold of you quickly. And so I had my friends pull the boat out of the water and gave them all the fish, by the way. And I called the skipper, and I said, yes, sir. He said, well, our ship, USS Stark, has been attacked in the Persian Gulf. And at the time, the reason I was selected is I was considered the master blaster of EOD Mobile Unit 2. So by title, probably the most experienced, not the master blaster of the EOD Navy, which is a recognition of tenure, but simply by my level of experience compared to the rest of the crew and availability. So I was a training officer. I was infinitely familiar. I'd been the operational readiness inspection officer. And I'd held a number of these things where I was constantly working and dealing and with these particularly foreign ordinances that I would train the guys to go overseas and be prepared to deal with. So my original tasking was a one-man team. I was going to go over for ComNav Surfland. And my original tasking order was to do a damage assessment on Stark regarding the SM-1 missiles, the torpedoes, Mark 46 torpedoes, and all other ordnance that she had on board. Not really sure, I remember at that time, what level of manuals I should take, but I just struck on the HMS Sheffield, the Exocet, and I remember reading that a number of them were being shipped by the French. So I took the publications. I knew it was a missile. I took the publications on all French missiles. I'd experienced the AS-12. I knew about the Exocet through other intel I'd read. And I assumed, regardless of what it was, the warheads were somewhat rudimentary and similar. So the flight and propulsion and guidance systems were typically the ones that were advanced in this period of time, particularly in foreign military sales to other countries by the French. Somewhere as I was waiting on the aircraft to come in, it was a SAM missile, special air mission by the Air Force. I'd get on the 141 and fly over to Bahrain. The XO talked to me. He says, "Do you want to bring another team?" And I said, "Sure. You know, I might have to do underwater inspections. It'd be great. Do you have a team available?" Because we were really shorthanded. And there was another team available, led by Lieutenant Norm Bond. And they were just in their pre-deployment training. They were at the point of being cohesive and operating well. So they came along. Norm and his team were assigned to me. We went, we got on the plane. The only stop we made, two stops. One was in Rota, again, to change crew. The other one was in Sigonella to pick up the 27 coffins. And from there, we went directly to Bahrain.
So your last stop was in Bahrain. And when you arrive, you're met by the staff from Commander Middle East Force. At that time, it was under the command of Admiral Hal Bernson. So what happens then?
So we clear the aircraft and go through the handling area, and the staff officers, the first one I met was a Navy 06 JAG that worked on the CMEF staff. And he, as we were walking, he's literally walking beside me, I'm trying to, and everybody is speaking at once. I remember four or five people, and I stopped and said, "Please, one person at a time." And this captain looked at me, and he opened a folder, and he says, "We're walking to we have the Admiral's barge. We're walking there." He says, I want you to look at this. This is debris that we found." And so I'm quickly looking through a stack of 8.5 by 11 black and white photographs, and I immediately recognize an unexploded Exocet warhead. And the Exocet was positioned in exactly how it should have operated. They have on what's called anti-ricochet pawls on that warhead, which are like four little angled feet. And it's designed that when it's going through a ship or metal, one of those feet would catch and reverse the travel direction and make it drop into the vessel and not punch a hole through the side. So I said, "Well, we've got a problem here. This is a UXO. It's no longer an inspection." And I said, we're going to have a lot of things that we have to consider now. We have to consider collateral effect, blast overpressure, personnel that are on the ship." I was advised that around the clock there were firefighting teams still doing reflash fires. Mostly they had to do it in the day with large fans and running power cores, because every bit of contained self-breathing in the Middle Eastern force had been used off of every ship, every OBA, every Scott air pack. It was something. So we got to LaSalle. I was invited to come up and brief the Admiral. And
LaSalle was the command ship that LaSalle, he was embarked?
Yes, it was a MEF command ship. So yeah, LSD, large white LSD.
Right.
So as I invited up to brief the admiral, he'd already been made aware from his JAG officer that we had a UXO, which is unexploded ordnance, on board. And of course, he wanted to know what were we going to do. Well, everybody went from okay, we're kind of doing the routine stuff, we're putting the fires out, and now I'm saying we need to button up LaSalle, we need to start sandbagging the vulnerable areas, and we need to get everybody off.
You have a large missile, and you now have to, the whole problem set has completely changed, because you've gone from, hey, we're just watching for reflash flyers, to you have unexploded ordnance. And oh, by the way, it's sitting close to a Ford magazine of a frigate filled with SM-1s and other ordnance.
That have been thermally damaged.
Right, yeah. And so everything is suspect in its condition.
Yes, sir. It was laying in the breezeway probably 20 feet from the Ford missile mag. What was the chief's quarters? Well, let me back up to the briefing.
Sure.
So I said, we're going to have to do a close-in. We're going to have to do a close-in, identify it. I know what it is from the picture, but in the OD operations, we always have to approach things with what am I doing, why am I doing it, how am I going to do it, and what's the end result going to be. So I needed the other three questions answered mentally in my mind before I could thoroughly brief the admiral. So I asked him to pull out the firefighting teams to secure the ship. You know, expect anything could happen at this point. We weren't going to attempt any kind of render safe or move it. We were simply going in to make a plan, what it is we're going to do. I invited the officer in charge of the other deck, Norm Bond, Lieutenant Norm Bond, to come with me. A couple of the guys, all being very proud and eager to be a part of this, I think felt a little left out. This was what they lived for, but when I will explain later, when I saw what we really had, what was the greater threat, I wasn't comfortable with bringing in basic EOD technicians now. So at my level and Norm's level, we would go in and do the close-in recon. I remember walking into Stark, going through a large space. It may have been the galley area. Everything was pitch black. Everything was burnt out. The wires were hanging down. The acrid smell of burning rubber and electrical stuff was thick in the air. And quite honestly, I'll never forget my very first thought. That is the first thing that ever made me have an inkling of fear, was that I was going to get electrocuted.
Because of all the exposed wires and everything.
Correct.
Yeah.
And Stark was laying in about 9 inches of water.
Oh, my gosh.
8 inches of water. So we had to muddle through the water in the main space. Couldn't quite walk directly up to her, so I was taken around the chief's quarters, where I simply walked through a bulkhead that didn't exist anymore. Being a former chief petty officer, initiated and for life, I was heartbroken just to stand there for a second, because the year earlier I had slept in those quarters on the other response to Coriana. So I was infinitely aware with every locker and berth, and all I'm looking at is a burnout space in the back bulkhead of the Ford missile launcher with a warped door, and thank God that door held up.
And what we know now because of this is that they had these extremely hot fires. The first missile came through, it didn't detonate, but it sent rocket fuel throughout all the spaces. Then when the second missile came through and did detonate, they had, you know, high temperature fires. I think it was over 3,000 degrees, and the aluminum was melting. I mean, it was just,
exactly.
You know, it's interesting. It almost would not have been as catastrophic an attack if both missiles had detonated. The fires really were devastating to that ship.
That's exactly what happened, and I had it firsthand knowledge from that I had the opportunity. You always talk to survivors for additional information before you go in and do an EOD procedure. And as you just stated, they were actually caught somewhat by surprise. They didn't have enough time to react to the missile coming in. It was like, oh my God, there it is. The first one passed through, and it it's a solid propulsion system, not fluid. And it lodged in the air conditioning system, which is massive in the chief's quarters. And it had its entire flight life of fuel. So it burned probably a minute at full thrust with that propellant going. And that was so hot, as you said, in excess of 3,000 degrees. The forward part of the missile, when it hit the ship at the port side and passed through the chief's quarters, the very front, the ogive, or the tip of the missile, is the electronics package. That just kept going, boom, in a straight line on the starboard side of the ship. There's an exit hole where that went out. And then right near that hole, the warhead was traveling behind it, and the anti-ricochet pole caught the starboard inside bulkhead and twisted it backwards and set it down in the breezeway. And the main propulsion system lodged in the air conditioner in the chief's quarters, and it burned until it burned out.
Yeah.
Almost immediately when this happened, they realized the second missile was coming, and so many people on the flybridge ran to look at the, oh my God, what just happened?
Right.
And when they were there at the flybridge, the second missile impacted on the outer bulkhead. It had enough, it's all called flight safe separation time.
Right.
All these missiles are given a safe separation period from the launching aircraft. So the reason the first one didn't go off is it didn't meet all the requirements to arm itself for safe separation. The second one did. And when they did that, the horror was everybody was looking out the window in a moment of shock, and that detonated, and it a lot of the deaths were the people were blown back into the bulkhead behind them on the flybridge.
Wow.
And I think that was the bulkhead for CIC right behind them. So it was a mess, and that's what they were dealing with. And they did a valiant job. A number of other ships came over and gave them OBAs and firefighting, and they saved their ship. But not to get too far off the EOD story, I just have to say this. I don't know the sailor's name. I'll never forget the story, and it brings tears to my eyes when I think about it. But the heat in the forward missile locker was so great, and I went in there afterwards, that it warped the bulkhead door, access door, from the berthing compartment. And one young sailor ran up there. I'll never forget it. I met him, and he turned that dog. He turned that hatch wheel with his hands. I mean, burnt the skin right off his hands. But he opened it and got a firefighting hose down in there. And that's probably what saved the ship and everybody's life. The thermal stress on those 16 SM-1 missiles was beyond belief.
Well, the two sailors that I have read about that I think were heroic in this event, the first one is GM3 Mark Samples, is recognized for putting firefighting water on the Ford magazine for over 13 hours. Initially, I think it was from the ship's P-250, and then apparently later a tug came alongside and passed a fire hose over, and they were able to do that. And the second one is Mark, and I believe it's pronounced Cayuette, who lost his leg in the initial attack. Some of his shipmates were trying to help him get out of the space. He said, "I'm not going to make it. I know that I'm just not going to make it." But he went, and the fire main in the space had parted, and fire main was spilling into the space, and he went and gave the last full measure, closing a fire main valve to isolate it so they could restore firefighting. He was found at the fire main closeout valve. So whenever we think of these cases, we always have to pause for a moment and think about the sailors that made the ultimate sacrifice serving our nation.
Absolutely. Thanks for letting me put that in there. So we get up, and I went, oh my. Because the pictures that I was shown of the Exocet, it's from the pretty side. It's the front of the warhead and the top, but it's not where what's called the SNA device, the safe and armed device, the brains, the detonator, the thing that's going to make that blow up. I had no idea what condition that was in. So we sludged through there. The warhead is half underwater in the breezeway. So picture this thing like a gray Navy desk trash can, about the size of that, tipped on its side, laying with about 5 inches of water. And in the center of that, the SNA device, I'll say, is probably 6 inches in diameter. So half of that, 3 inches, is submerged. So we're kind of sneaking up on it. I don't know why, but Norm and I were sneaking up on it. And we're talking, and we're trying to figure out ways. The whole time we're coming up is, how do we secure this? How do we stop it from moving? No matter what we do in the next couple of steps, we have to isolate this and secure it. And we're looking at what our capabilities. So we determined the warhead was leaning up against the inside wall of the breezeway. And we were able to get some dunnage and debris and sandbags and put on the outside. So, you know, anything can happen. You know, a 40-knot wind gust breeze makes a ship move, and things move when ships move. And even though she had an incredible list, I don't know, I don't remember how many degrees, but she was probably over 20 degrees listing, still carrying all the water in her belly from firefighting. We secured her, and man, I wish we had iPhones then, because it would have been so nice to take a picture and instantly send it back to the world. But we looked and we said, this is a mess. And we had our battle lantern, said, well, we need to go back and get some masks. And we had brought our dive gear because it was always in the plan that we would do an underwater inspection of the hull after the render safe portion was over. We looked and we said, we got a problem here. The SNA device was like a mangled hunk of black with wires coming out right and left.
And this is where you thought, when you perform a render safe procedure for the missile, it was going to be, you were going to be addressing the SNA device.
This is it. This right. is where you have to go right. to do something. And always in EOD operations, you break the explosive train, to put it in simple terms. So this is where the action of breaking, separating the detonator from the main warhead would occur. So we took a minute and we brought a clipboard. Literally, guys, we were doing stuff with clipboards and pencils. And we took a long time, Norm and I. The ship was getting frustrated. They kept calling us, but we were there. 2 feet away, Norm had the light, I had the clipboard, and we're doing a detailed drawing, as much 3D as we can, and writing notes, and this at the 2 o'clock position, here's this wire, and making our drawing, because this is what's going to determine what direction we take from here forward, is that intelligence we bring back from the close-in reconnaissance. So I go back, we go back on board, Norm and I. We briefed the team because, in all fairness, they are completely amped up, you know, and they want to be a part of this. They are the team.
So this is back on LaSalle now?
Back on LaSalle, yeah. And it wasn't so urgent that everybody was, like, waiting for us. We had to schedule a meeting with the Admiral. And so they scheduled that, and I would say 30 minutes later, I don't remember if Norm was with me or not, but I went up and I recall showing the drawing and explaining everything. And I also talked to the Admiral at that time. Part of the first considerations in any EOD operation is collateral damage. So we have formulas of blast overpressure, you know, dangerous areas, the explosive weight calculated out to where you think percussion or fragmentation will fly. And in that, we make these explosive arcs or these safety arcs, or we call them standoff, you know, the standoff area where people should be removed from.
And in this case, it's not just the Exocet missile, but now you have to add to that the potential that it's going to cause a detonation within the forward magazine. So you have to add up the net explosive weight of everything that's in the magazine, too.
You're exactly right. Plus the Mark 46 torpedoes and all other ammunition. So everything is in such close proximity, you have to assume if there's a detonation, you have to take that total weight and make that your exclusion area. At this point, I remember briefing the Admiral and I said, here are the things that I see around us. Over to our 4 o'clock, maybe 200 meters, is a LNG tanker. I don't know, 600, 700 feet, but she's showing no water line.
Meaning she's full.
Meaning she's full, right. Over to our 9 o'clock is another one just like that. And I believe the other one was probably over about 11 o'clock. And they're all about a third of a mile away from us. Behind us, maybe a half mile, not much more, is NSA and the city of Bahrain. And over to the left, as we're laying there over to the left, the 9 o'clock beyond the tanker is what I remember was, it looked to me like it was a fueling facility, probably
right.
The LNG fueling facility,
sure.
For loading the tanker or taking it off the tanker, one or the other. So I spoke with the admiral and I said, you know, I said the risk of collateral damage is beyond comprehension. If those missiles, if everything gets a collateral detonation, I can't tell you what would happen to those LNG tankers. I mean, I can only imagine what would happen if those detonate. And I said, this has to go into our consideration of the exclusion circle. And I said, my recommendation at this point is let us have your Mike 8 boat. We know there's an exit hole where the electronics package went through the starboard hull of Stark. Give me a fold-up litter. If we can render safe the warhead, let me pass it through that exit hole onto the camel that Stark is tied to LaSalle, separated by a camel. And the team and myself will put this on a Mike 8 boat, and we will leave the harbor. And we'll go out to sea and detonate it. There was a lot of discussion back and forth. And the answer, the final answer to that is that we had given assurances, the embassy had given assurances that there was no great risk other than the routine firefighting and damage control that was going on currently on board Stark. And for reasons that they made, they did not want to take that recommendation.
Political reasons, in other words, is what I'm hearing. Yeah.
Correct.
So now the story becomes, okay, Tony, you guys need to render safe this and be able to figure out a way to package it up safely and exfil it out of here, because we're not going to tell anybody that you're moving a warhead out to sea and then you're going to detonate it, because then that's going to become very obvious, right, what happens, and that's going to create very uncomfortable conversations for them. So now all of a sudden the problem sets become even more difficult, I think.
Exactly, and I want to say this is really, these are the uncalculated considerations that the officer in charge has faced when responding to these. Every EOD situation has a handful of uncalculated norms. We calculate blast overpressure. We calculate safe standoff distances. We calculate weights and measurements. And we quasi-calculate what the end result is going to be if we fail. But we can't calculate things beyond our control, such as this. So if our recommendation is not taken, then our calculations are not useful at that point. So in EOD, there used to be a prioritization system called AAABC as to the threat. And in a category A situation in EOD operations was written that the personal loss of life was deemed far less significant than the end result of the detonation. And so at all costs, you would stay on it and take it to the end, hopefully to a successful result. So we were sending flash traffic. First of all, let me say this. The render safe procedure is written in the U.S. EOD publications for all services governed by the Navy. There were no render safe procedures. It was take to safe disposal area. That was it. That means nobody knows anything about it. Nobody knows how to do it. We have no history on it. There's nothing they can offer to assist you. There was no technical thing being written that hadn't been released yet. It's a complete unknown.
So my instinct is it's time to call the French and ask them to hand over a render safe procedure.
That's correct. And we did ask that. And we waited for hours and to no avail. And I don't know where it got turned off. All I know is that we never got an answer.
I should add for clarity, we had to call the French because the Exocet is a French-made missile. The Mirage aircraft that they were normally employing them was a French-made aircraft, and the Exocet was a French-made missile.
Exact same one that went down the stack of Her Majesty's ship Sheffield in the Falkland Wars a year earlier and blew up and sank the ship, just like the Bismarck.
Yeah. So there's no answer from the French embassy, no answer from the French government. Now what?
Well, we have to do something. We're getting tired. We've been going about 30 hours now. And so there's a thing that I was raised in the Navy and always held in awe called flash traffic, flash message traffic. We were always trained. If you're at the end of Timbuktu and you need to get an answer and it's critical, send a flash message. And within 10 minutes, no matter where the recipient in the world is, he'll get it and he'll give you a response. This is an absolute truthful statement. We sent at least 5 flash messages and nothing came back. And this was to our EOD technical division in Indian Head, Stumpnick, Maryland. Whether they got it or not, I'm sure they had it. They have a huge telecommunication system there. So we didn't get the response. So back then, the most secure way of talking was a thing called a STU-3 phone line. Probably has less encryption than talking on LinkedIn these days. But the admirals offered me to use the STU-3 phone, or actually Captain Kelly from the EOD Technical Division, with Master Chief Bobby Gwynn, the renowned Bobby Gwynn, who was retired EOD Master Chief and became the main exploiter for farm material acquisition and ran the D-Mill lab up in Stumpnick, were able to get on a STU-3 call, and we were able to communicate directly now. What a relief, what a relief. So they tell me, after we described everything and we went over my drawing again, and all they have in their mind is what they can picture how I described it. You remember I had the piece of paper, I started at the 1 o'clock position, I went around the compass rose and said everything I saw at different points of the compass rose, and then anything in the center I described where some of the aluminum is melted down, some is covering, melted onto the skin. And they came back and they said, cut the yellow wire. I'll never forget that. You're not allowed to use four-letter words. So I laughed and I went, you may have missed the point in my briefing that I sent, that everything is thermally scorched. There is no yellow, pink, red. Everything is pitch
black. It's all black. All the wires are black at this point.
Everything's black. And on top of that, a portion of aluminum, maybe from the chief's locker room, is melted on top of the SNA device. And we can't get down and really do what we want to do until we get this aluminum off. So Norm and I go back down with a hacksaw, looking through one eye underwater and one eye above, and we start filing off the aluminum until we could get the few pieces that were blocking 100% view of what we had. Very slow and tedious process. So we get it off, go back up and brief one more time on the STU-3. And I said, well, this one's up to me then. And unless otherwise directed, this is my course of action. And I can't go into exactly what we did, but we did a few things that I feel, well, obviously it worked, that made it safe to transport.
You used your years of experience and you took a calculated risk and it led to a successful result.
Right. And you know, when we went over, it was never in the game plan to bring the warhead back to America. now that we had it on a litter and we could move it, you know, in that first 10 feet of juggling and pass it through the side of the ship and being on the Catamel, if it didn't go off then, you probably, there's a high confidence factor that this thing is safe. It's not going
to
go off.
Well, I can imagine as time goes on, you start to become more and more comfortable with the idea that this thing is not going to function as designed, right?
That's, you're absolutely correct. And consistent with that thought process, other people were thinking that.
Of course.
And so I got a call and said, is there any way you can bring this home? We want to exploit it. And, you know, he said, we've run into another one, and we still don't have any RSP, render safe procedures. So one of the guys on my team was an excellent welder, and we used to have these things back then called cruise boxes, collapsible aluminum boxes about 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet that folded up and folded out. And we got the warhead in that cruise box. We welded handles on the side out of rebar. We welded all the hinges that allowed the box to collapse and all that so it was solid. And then we foamed the warhead inside the box.
This sounds like the Navy's Ark of the Covenant thing from Indiana Jones with handles on the side and an Exocet missile inside.
That's exactly what it was. Rebar handles with electrical tape wrapped over the outside. And we got a safe to transport, and we ended up putting that on a C-141 that took it back to Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. The EOD Technical Division from Stump Neck was there. They took custody of the warhead. They brought it back to Stump Neck. Master Chief Bobby Glenn exploited it. And once they had it in their hands, I mean, they have huge cobalt X-rays that can go through cannonballs, and they can really look at everything, and they have robotic arms for disassembly. And once they got to their comfort level is, let's go ahead and disassemble this. And once you can disassemble it, you can write procedures, render safe procedures for it, should you come across it in the future. So that warhead was the first documented series of render safe procedures were developed off of that for all. EOD is a multi-service community. So for all EOD forces in all branches of the service. After the warhead was exploited at the Tech Div in Indian Head, Maryland, they had the capability now to engineer and build SNA devices that they could use and write procedures for and install and let sailors of the future face it and know how to take it apart with the procedures they developed. So that was then taken to the EOD Training Unit 2 at Fort Story, Virginia, where they had just built a shipboard trainer for live response on battle-damaged ships. That's about the last time I saw it in use. I remember talking to a few of the young sailors talking about the challenge of having to hoist a warhead out of the two compartments down into a ship, and I was happy that kids would learn from that and they wouldn't have to face it as an unknown in the future.
And so what's interesting is it's very visceral is these guys are then training with the warhead that is the actual warhead that was that hit the Stark. And so that just really, I think, sends a message to them. But one of my favorite stories, Tony, is about your retirement ceremony. Tell about how the warhead showed up there.
Yeah, my XO. So retirement's always a big deal. I had two things occur at once, my change of command, turning it over to the new CO, and my subsequent retirement. And they always say in EOD, everybody has that one save the world mission they get to take to the grave with them. And we've all done a lot of things and numerous IEDs and cheating death scenarios, but there's always that special one that your name is on it. And so there I'm with my family and all my relatives and all my friends, and few people have ever heard about this. And during the retirement ceremony, the warhead was wheeled out on a cart, and a brief description of it was given. And I know I had a large grin on my face, and that was it.
And just think, if they had authorized you, if a Middle East force had authorized you to take it out and detonate it at sea, it wouldn't have been there for your retirement ceremony as a memory of that whole harrowing event. And what's interesting is today, the warhead is in Preble Hall. It is part of the Operation Ernest Will diorama or display, which when you walk into the building, if you turn to the right, it's over on the right-hand side. So I recommend listeners go in and take a look at that. And remember that Tony Nehechevansky and Norm Bond were the ones that were there and performed that render safe procedure, and that's why we get to see it today.
One day, I go to Annapolis from time to time. One day, Steve, I'd love to call you and be invited into Preble Hall and take a viewing of it.
Absolutely. There's an open invitation, and so we look forward to you coming and visiting us there. And so thank you, Lieutenant Commander Tony Nehechevansky, United States Navy retired, the officer who led the render safe procedure of the Exocet missile on USS Stark. Thank you for joining me today on Preble Hall.
You're quite welcome. It was my pleasure.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.